You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. And I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust. My guest this week, like James Pritchett, needs no introduction in cage circles, being the founder of Mode Records, which at 54 volumes in its Cage edition, has produced more commercial recordings of Cage's music than any other label. Mode's catalog of over 300 releases includes music of the great composers of the last half of the 20th century, as well as today's aspiring new music artists. Beginning with its very first release in 1984, a 2-LP set containing John Cage's Etudes Borealis, Mode has presented uniquely curated releases with emphasis on producing fine recordings of works that are not necessarily a part of current mainstream musical fashion. This curated aspect of Mode is important and has led to its loyal following. This is not a label run by committee, but rather one built on Brandt's personal vision. As Brian relates, he was always an avid music lover, record collector, and listener. And while he did not intend to start a record label, it happened thanks to a chance encounter with Cage himself, who made the suggestion. Working with Cage from 1984 until his death, Brian learned much about the interpretation of Cage's music, giving Mode releases of Cage's works a particular authenticity. And it would be through Cage that Brandt was introduced to countless musicians and composers, and through them to countless more. See Mode's catalog for releases of the works of other such iconic composers as Morton Feldman, Yannis Xenakis, Morton Subotnick, and Giacinto Chelsea, among many others. So welcome, Brian Brandt, to All Things Cage.
Thank you.
I have so many questions to ask you. You told me once a very beautiful story about how John Cage turned you into a record producer, and that was in 1984 with your first recording. How did you meet John Cage?
That's kind of fun because at that time in the early 1980s, I was going to many concerts each week in New York City. And very often you would see John at these things. They weren't playing his music. He would be there, especially at these various loft concerts like at the Kitchen and so on. So just because we would be at the same events so many times, he and I acknowledged each other because we kept recognizing each other. All along, a huge record collector. And anyone that I became interested in, and John Cage at that time was one of them, I had to have everything that was recorded of their music. So one day he was sitting at a concert during intermission and no one was around him. And I just kind of got the guts up to finally go over and speak to him after having eye contact with him for I don't know how many months or years. I asked him if anything new was coming out. And he said, well, these musicians were playing these new works of his. This was Etudes Borealis, very beautifully, but no one seemed to want to record them. And I don't know why, but I just suggested, well, maybe I can do it. And he said, oh, that would be marvelous. And he gave me his phone number, which is kind of interesting because just the other week, I pulled out my LP set of Indeterminacy and I was listening to that. And stuffed inside that box set were all these different clippings and concert flyers from way back when. And sure enough, there was this concert flyer. I think it was for the New Music Consort, something like that, with John Cage's handwriting of his name and address on it. And I suspect, I can't be absolutely certain, but the timing is kind of right, that this must have been that very moment when he gave me his information so I could make possibly a record of his music.
Well, anyway, but wait, I want to know, why did he think you could make a record?
Because I said maybe I could.
And why did you say that?
I don't know.
That's so great. So you just said, okay, well, maybe I could. You loved records.
I loved records, and I listened to records very intensely too. And I knew what I liked about records, and I had thousands of them. I knew what I liked about sound. I liked certain ways that they were packaged. I liked them to have good liner notes. And also, I was kind of dealing with a mail order record business on the side at that time. So I was dealing with hard to find records and imported things, audiophile records. So I knew distributors already because I was buying from them. So I had knowledge of the business, but I never made a record. So anyway, I then had to figure out how to make a record. So I did some research. I found an engineer. I found a studio that was in Soho at the time. I don't know how much time transpired, but after I got all the details together, I called up John and I told him that, okay, I think, you know, I can do this. And, you know, that would be marvelous. And he came to the recording session. The first one was with Francis Marie Uidi and Michael Pugliese.
Wasn't that Rio?
No, that's the Etudes Borealis.
Really?
Rio Anji was added later because we ended up with a record that was too long. Uh-huh. So we had one side free, and then John suggested, let's do Rio Anji.
I see. Okay.
So John came to the studio for that first recording with Andrew Colbert, and it was just fantastic, the whole thing. And when that record was finished, I went over to John's, and he was so happy because he had done the cover, actually. He had done a rock drawing for the cover. He volunteered that. And then when I brought the records to him, he was so pleased with them that he suggested that he would sign and number an edition of them so that I could sell them for more money and make some more money, which was really wonderful. And a little known secret about that is that he numbered them as an edition of 200, but actually he only ever signed 100 of them. So there's really just 100 of them. There's not.
So the signage is one of 200.
One of 200, but there never was anything from above 100. He only did.
Oh, that makes it all the more fun, actually.
Yeah. I think this is the first time I've ever admitted that in public.
It's okay. It happens all the time, these weird things with editions.
Yeah.
I think Tony Kramer just bought two of these from you, didn't he?
About a summer or two ago, yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean just now. I mean pre-COVID. It was the last time we did the music circus at Bard.
That's right.
And I remember him coming up to me, and he almost had them like contraband inside of his coat. And he pulled them out and kind of showed me his, you know, his good fortune. And then he shoved them back in.
So then, you know, much to my amazement, because I had no idea what to do with this record label. I didn't plan on having a record label, but I had a record. And because I knew some distributors, I was able to get it distributed, which is not easy to do if you only have one release, because, you know, generally they want a catalog of things. But I had my foot in the door, and that worked. And everything was going fine. It was selling and so on. This was an LP, of course, right? Some months later, I get a phone call, and it's, hi, Brian, it's John. I have another record for you. And that kind of answered my question. So there was record number two. So first record was a two LP set. And of course, the second record had to be a four LP set.
And what was the second one?
That was Atlas Eclipticalis.
Oh, that's right.
Winter Music. And it was two performances that were recorded that John had conducted with the new performance group of the Cornish Institute. I think it came out in 1986. And both of these records, I had them manufactured in Germany because I thought the quality of the pressings was superior. So we actually went through all the trouble to have them made over there instead of here.
Forgive me for the personal question, but the first time I met your first wife, mm-hmm. Eileen?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny that I haven't seen her in, 40 years? But I remember her. I met her in Germany. We were all in Germany together.
For your opera, right?
Maybe. I can't remember why we were there, but I just remember that was the only time. That was the first time I met her, and I don't think I ever saw her again. But I was impressed by her driving skills in a strange city. Anyway, so you did the two LPs with Cage and then you moved into CDs, right? Pretty quickly.
Yes. Well, CDs were the new thing then and everybody wanted them. But I always loved LP. So what ended up happening with John was we started to have a rapport together. I expressed interest to do more of his music. So he started to invite me to come to concerts with him where there were performances of his music. And I learned a lot from that because I'm actually not a musician, but I'm a very good listener. So at the end of performances, you know, he would tell me what he thought. And sometimes he would say it's marvelous. And sometimes he would say, oh, that was hopeless. Right. And then, you know, I could also see him interact with the musicians. And what was really beautiful about Cage was if he was very fond of the performance, even if it wasn't maybe to what his standards really had hoped it to be, if he felt the musicians were really trying, he would really go back and speak with them.
Sure.
And kind of coach them a little bit. I thought this was really fantastic. And so I really came to know the aesthetic.
Yeah, no, I can understand perfectly. Yeah. You know, people are always, you probably experienced this as well. People are always surprised by the fact that Cage was opinionated about a good performance versus a bad performance. Mm-hmm. You know, that he had very strong feelings about that.
Yes. And with the later works, of course, they have so much flexibility, although they don't have so much flexibility. It's kind of
an illusion. It's an illusion.
It's an illusion of flexibility, yes. But it's very easy for interpreters to abuse this. And it's also very easy for them to also kind of take a cheap way out with the music. To me, it's very clear when you hear if the musicians really are attuned to Cage's aesthetic or not. And it makes a world of difference in the sound of the performance. So really, you know, during these years of working with him, you know, side by side on and hearing these, you know, performances, and he came in the early days to a lot of the recordings that Mode put out, it taught me a lot about his music. There was actually something very beautiful he said to me, because I can't remember which recording it was, but I wanted him to come to this new recording session. We had made several records together now. He was busy. And he said to me, Brian, you don't need me there any longer, which I thought was really fantastic. So he trusted me.
Uh-huh. Brian, did you bring players to his attention or did he bring them to you for recordings?
No, that was fantastic, actually, because in the early days, probably for most of the time when Cage was still alive, he directed performance to me. And this was kind of essential for me and for the label, for Mode Records, because I didn't know these performers personally. So a lot of times if musicians were passing through town in New York, he would arrange a meeting at his loft, sometimes over dinner or over tea or whatever, and have me meet these different musicians, because he would say to me, these are the musicians, or this musician is the person to play these works. This way, it ensured getting a somewhat definitive recording. Mm-hmm.
It also gave you an endorsement, an implicit endorsement by mm-hmm. him. So it helped you probably make relationships really fast.
Yes.
Because you had a stamp of approval from John Cage.
Yeah. You can't get much better than that.
It's lovely. It's lovely. Yeah. That, so an example would be like the Arditi Quartet, like Irvine Arditi. Is that how you met him?
Yes. He put that together.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is that what you mean when you say, because I've heard you reference your first recording and you talk about it as a co-production with John Cage. It's because you didn't know what you were doing in the beginning, and he had strong ideas about music, and he provided the player and he provided the composition. And so that's his part of it. And you right. made it technically possible.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. you had a good year.
I guess. And I mean, I think this is also very, very important because, you know, people always talk about, you know, Cage not caring about recordings, but actually he did care about recordings. He didn't care to listen to them mm-hmm. after they were done, but he did care very much that the music was being performed well. Not so much about how the recording sounded. This was not really of interest to him, but the quality of the performance was very important.
That would be my take as well. He didn't even have a turntable in his house. And I must have met you not long after that started, because I came on the scene in the spring of 86. So that would have been the year of around your first CD with him.
No, 86 would have been around the time of the second release.
Oh, that's right. That's right. 88 was the first CD.
Yeah.
So it must have been around your operas in Frankfurt that I first met.
Yeah, that's why I was in Germany now.
Yeah.
Because we had hoped to, you know, make an arrangement to have it recorded. And then, of course, the fire happened and there was no performance. And I was not able to go back again.
For our listening audience, let me interrupt you just one second, Brian. So this is a composition by John Cage called Your Operas 1 and 2. It was written from 85 to 87, and then it premiered in Frankfurt for the Frankfurt Au Pair, for which it was written, except that it was supposed to be on the main stage of the Frankfurt Opera, but a fire broke out a couple of weeks before and destroyed a goodly amount of the house. And so the premiere was postponed, I forget, Brian, from like October to December or something like that. And it was done in the smaller Schauspiel house, right? Did you stay for the opening?
No, I couldn't go back for that. So I actually didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Anyway,
and that's still something I would love to release. There is a recording that they made, the German radio made of the premiere. So someday. Hopefully.
Yeah. I was just thinking, as you said, that you had hoped to record it, which would have been a very ambitious project for you that early on in your career as a record producer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's such an unwieldy work. I mean, it's a hard work, I should think, to record. But it brought me back to how many years ago, not so long, Brian, when we were out in LA, because Yuval Sharon, as an ensemble out there, and he produced your operas 1 and 2 in a soundstage, and a film industry soundstage. And you tried very hard to record that.
Yes.
And that didn't work out. So it's like you've been trying to do this for 35 years.
Right. And then I also tried to record it just recently in Germany. It was performed again.
Yep.
And that looked very positive, but that didn't work out. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this, but I think it's also important at this point to say that Cage also was helpful to me with the label, because he also knew that I was interested in a lot of other contemporary composers. He would find ways for me to get in contact with them too, other composers I wanted to record. And this was also fantastic. So, you know, little by little, the whole scope of Mode Records grew out. I mean, it could have just been primarily a Cage label, but thanks to him too, I was able to reach out to other composers. And now pretty much it basically is just like a big umbrella for all kinds of music that I like, and which is not necessarily of one style either. And also just getting back to the Europa's question, again, John was influential in getting me in contact with the different directors, they call them redaktors in Germany, of the various German radio stations. And German radio is a huge thing, especially at that time, because they were constantly making recordings, not just recordings of live concerts, but also studio recordings. And they had superb studio recording situations. So I was able to also record a lot of Cage's music through the German radios.
The WDR, like Klaus Schoening?
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. and the Hessischer Rundfunk in Frankfurt, uh-huh. and some others. So I had a good rapport with the redactors back then, and we did a lot of records together. And it was a whole different world back then, you know, to do these kinds of recordings because it wasn't so contract oriented. You know, these reductors were as interested to do these recordings of Cage as I was. So they made it happen, which is like a beautiful thing. They still, some of them would like to make these things happen, but their hands are much more tied now. They can't just will it to happen and it happens any longer.
Was that the case, say, in the German production, the recent German production? Not the Heiner Müller back in 2012, but the one that just happened in 2017 or 16, whatever that was.
Oh, yes. Well, that you mean, you're talking about that performance of Europas 1 and 2?
Exactly. Yes. What was the breakdown? Why couldn't you do that? Why in the end did you not do that?
In the end, that was because of primarily of money. And also the LA one also broke down because of money, but it was money for a different reason. Because the budget to record that one was extremely high because of the musician fees.
So the union costs of the production itself.
Right. Whereas the one in Germany, it was easier to deal with that aspect, but I just couldn't get the whole thing together. We tried to get some, the funding didn't come through. There were just a lot of complicated things going on outside of trying to make that recording happen. And I just eventually had to let it go.
Yeah. It's touching. The audience should know that Brian Brandt is known as the record producer who has made a commitment for many years to capture on a recording every work by John Cage. And this particular work has eluded him for 30 years or so now. And it's a work that is performed very often. And it's not something you can do in a studio. So it has to be a live performance. It has to be this expensive endeavor, much more so than, you know, a string quartet in a nice acoustically sound room. So it's just really too bad. And I think that you can speak to this, Brian, but I think you want to do every Cage work as much for yourself as you do for John Cage, that you told him that way back.
Well, I never told him that, actually. But
you didn't?
No. Huh. But especially after he passed away, I came to realize, and you know, the label was getting larger and larger and was viable and had some prestige and so on. And I realized I would never have done this record label, which kind of changed my life and all for the good. And I would never have done it if it wasn't for John.
Of course.
So I felt I owed him something. I had a lot of respect for him. So it just seemed possible for the longest time to just make it a goal that before I pass away, I will have documented all of Cage's music. I guess I'm maybe somewhere three quarters of the way in at this point. There are certain works, especially large scale works like Europas 1 and 2 and some orchestra pieces and things like that, which are very, very difficult to do. And, you know, to find a situation where you can make a recording, because a lot of the big pieces, you have to kind of base the recording around a performance where it's already being rehearsed and put together, because to bring that amount of people together for a recording session is hugely expensive. What's happened with the record business, especially post 2008, which was a really bad year, not only for global economics, but also very shortly after that, which had an effect on the music business, on sales.
Of course, it had an effect on almost everything.
Yeah. But also after that, there was maybe some of the audience will remember, there was the appearance of Napster, which brought on this whole situation of digital piracy.
Right. I remember it vividly.
Yeah. And the music business, you know, in general handled that rather poorly. It became clear after just a few years that there was no way to really stop piracy. You just can't control it. It's too easy with the digital processes. So, you know, this hurt business again, And of course, in more recent years, it changed again, where it starts to move away from people purchasing physical product, for which even though it costs real money to make these things, you have a fair profit margin. So like for Mode Records, I've always kept it rather lean, the label, which means primarily me as the employer employee.
Right, right.
But also, I kind of lost my train of thought, my apologies.
You're just talking about the profit margin possibility on physical objects. So
I was able to put out enough records all the time, and each new record up to around shortly after 2008 always had a spike in sales when you put it out. So you got this quick injection of new cash, and somehow it just fed everything. You were able to repress old titles if they were going out of stock, and you were able, I did a lot of recordings out of my own pocket. I was able to fund new recordings and put out new records and so on. And then what happened in these recent years, especially as the physical sales went down, and then downloads, which still pay okay, sales of downloads started to drop, and you have this supremacy of streaming.
Right.
Streaming doesn't pay anything. You might as well almost give the music away. So with that, you don't make enough money to really fund things anymore. So most recording projects that I'm working on these days, either they have to be partly or fully funded in order to make them. And this really is like working with one arm behind your back, because you can't really do what you want to do anymore. I was used to doing what I wanted to do.
I wanted to do something, I made it happen.
You know?
Yes, but what you wanted to do was within your means. It was streamlined. It was simple. I mean, you made that a point. You weren't in the Playboy Mansion.
No.
Cigars. You know what I mean?
No. So to get back to this idea of the Cage Edition, up until these times in the 2000s, it really did seem possible to pretty much make that goal. But with these various economical changes now, it's kind of come to me, I'm 64 years old now, that might not be possible to get this goal of the Cage Edition. And it's mostly, unfortunately, due to economics.
Right. Last count, I think you had 54 in the edition.
Right. The new record, which will be out in about a month, is the 54th. Yeah.
That's 54.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And that's, if listeners remember, if you were tuned in a few weeks ago, that was the subject of a conversation with James Pritchett, the author of The Music of John Cage, where we talked a lot about the new Mode release that's coming out of that includes Morton Feldman's trio arrangement of John Cage's solo piano version of Cheap Imitation, which itself is an arrangement of the Satie Sokrat.
That's right.
We got to hear the whole complicated story. But this is Mode. This is Brian Brandt, also known as Mode Records, who is putting out that CD, which should be out in May, you think, Brian?
Yes, in May.
Yeah. It's a really nice recording. We got to listen to the second movement, which is the one where the two parts play at the same time instead of in sequence. And it's the counterpoint is created. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah. And this was, you know, very special because like a lot of pieces on Mode's Cage Edition, it's a first recording.
Well, don't you have two works on that CD that are first recordings?
Well, there's this other piece, which is kind of
spurious.
Yeah, you could say that. Yes. So it's a piece which is attributed by some to Cage and by others not. But when it was brought to my attention, I gave it to Aki Takahashi. I thought it was actually a Cage piece because of the way it was described to me. And it may or may not be, but in the end, it doesn't really matter, I think, because it's a beautiful piece and she plays it really fabulously. And it's a piece that the interpreter has to kind of make their own version of the materials.
That they it's have. Very little, right? It's a very short piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It has what is it called? Something about a stone.
It's a very long title. And the funny thing was it was written
I
on the
look
back.
It up.
It's several sides of the small stone, I think, given to
James Tenney
as a Cohen. All sides of the small stone for Eric Satie.
Oh yeah, all sides of a small stone.
For Eric Satie and secretly given to Jim Tenney as a Cohen.
In 1978.
And it was discovered on the back of some Jim Tenney score. And I can't remember exactly why right now it had been attributed Cage from that.
No, I think it's signed.
It's signed.
The score is signed.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's questionable. It doesn't quite look like his signature. Not quite. It's hard to know, you know? It's hard to know.
Well, all those people that try to forge Cage's signature, so.
Not me.
And what, but anyway, it's also on that record as a first recording. And the rest of the record is also contains some Cage Satie related works.
Isn't Cheap Imitation itself on there? Did Aki play
both versions? Yes.
Yes, so like she does the Cage version.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, the original. And then the Morton Feldman, and then the small stone piece for James Tenney.
Plus swinging and.
Yeah. Excellent. I can't wait. I mean, I've heard little bits of it. Thanks to you. Thank you, by the way, for contributing audio to our show every now and then. It's really nice.
Oh, my pleasure.
Your catalog is beautiful. I mean, your CDs are just gorgeous. So I just feel really lucky. What are you doing these days? You moved, that was a couple of years ago, right? You moved to the Hudson Valley. You're over in our neck of the woods, kind of. You're across the river, but you're actually very close. Are you enjoying being out of the city?
Yes, actually, very much so. This was a little surprising to me because I was always a New York boy. You know, I was born in the Bronx. I grew up in Queens. I lived in Manhattan for 20 some odd years. And then I ended up here. And I think for me at this point, up here is really perfect. I feel really good being up here. And my mind is kind of at peace. And maybe I'm feeling more like John.
You know, he always had fantasies of moving to Bolivia.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Why Bolivia?
That's exactly what I said. Why Bolivia? And he said, because nobody there cares about modern music. So it was when he was feeling, you know, beleaguered, like everybody wanted things from him. He said it to me in response to why he had so many houseplants. Because the house was just full of cacti and succulents and trees and flowers. And he said he was trying to make it look like Bolivia. And I said, why Bolivia? And he said, because he wanted to move there one day. And I said, why Bolivia?
Did he ever go to Bolivia?
No, of course not. It was a fantasy that he had. But he made, do you remember, Brian? I want to say it was 1988. I have searched through my papers for it. Do you remember him making this misostic, it was titled Bolivia Mix, and it was a little small binder of misostic poetry that he put together. I want to say maybe it was after the Harvard lectures, because he used newspaper clippings, which he had done in the Harvard lectures. So it was an idea that he had. He gave them away as Christmas presents. Do you remember this at all?
No, I don't remember that.
Uh-huh. I'll see if I still have it. I'll make you a Xerox. I'll bootleg you a copy.
Okay.
It was just a Christmas present. He just did it for friends. We have one in our archives, but I also found it just happenstance on the internet one day being sold. So I wrote to them a really mean email. And I think
if he gave it away, those people.
Exactly. Yes. Why not? Yes. It wasn't a published thing. You know, it was just I think it was stapled. It had like red construction paper as a cover. It was very crude.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Bolivia, there's that Bolivia again.
Right, know? Right.
Yeah.
How strange.
Have you ever been?
No.
No, me neither. So what are you doing here? that's different than New York. How is your life different? I mean, all of our lives are different, so it's a little bit unfair. But how do you pass your time in the Hudson Valley? Are you making friends here?
Well, it's slow going because, you know, the pandemic hit as I was really kind of just settling in. Mm-hmm. So no, I haven't made very many friends up this way yet, but that may change, of course, as pandemic restrictions lift. But it's kind of nice because I'm here on my own and I still have my big record collection. I have my stereo set up now and I listen to music all the time. Uh-huh. It's like my best friend. So it always keeps me company.
It's a very beautiful place to live and can be outdoors a lot, but it's been a harsh winter. And with COVID, it's been really hard.
It has been hard.
We can't congregate. We can't socialize. We can't, you know, can't do anything. So for people who live alone, it's particularly hard.
Yeah. Well, I think two things really work in my favor for being up here. And one is the fact that the music keeps me company. And it sounds really great in the place where I'm living because it has very high ceilings and so on. So it's like a joy. And the other thing is I still have Mode Records to deal with. It's even more solitary in a way now because I can't, in general, have people come in to do any work with me. So consequently, I do most of the work really myself. So it keeps me busy every day. And every day there's emails and every day there's orders to deal with and, you know, projects that are in various stages of planning and production. So I do have contact with people, but it's virtual, you know.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Email kind of contact, the occasional Zoom thing like we're having now.
Yeah. It's become our lives. It's whole kind of, you know, virtual connections and, you know, all of it. It's very strange.
But I'm lucky because I was already kind of in this mode of doing things all my life, basically, with the record business. So aside from friendly outside contact, my life hasn't changed.
When's the last time you were in Manhattan?
I did have to go down recently because I had to pick up a hard drive, believe it or not, and deliver it to an engineer. So, but I've only been down to Manhattan since March, maybe half dozen times.
Uh-huh. It's a funny world.
It's strange there to some degree.
Is it? I haven't been back. I haven't been
not at all.
December of 2019.
Wow, that's way longer than me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't making regular trips to the city anyway. Mm-hmm. At this stage, we're at Bard College and we're swamped all the time. So it's really kind of hard to get away. And plus the cessation of travel, air travel I'm talking about, I would piggyback on, say, a trip to France if I had to go, or Germany or something. I would go through the city. So I would stay in the city for a night or two and reconnect with people and do work in the city. But all of that stopped, you know, travel stopped. So there was no point in going down to the city and coming back up. And then we were in lockdown anyway. Train travel was diminished and all of it. It was bad. Did you drive?
Yeah.
Do you still collect cars, by the way?
Well, I still have the cars that
you still have the cars that you've collected.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I still have them.
You're a Citroen guy, if I recall.
That's right. There was a great story. It was getting back to John and Citroens in a cursory way. I was in Europe and Cage and Cunningham were in Europe together. And John wanted me to hear this premiere of, it was one of the organ pieces. I can't recall exactly which one, but it was being done in Strasbourg.
Mm-hmm. It might've been As Slow As Possible too.
I had rented a Citroën. I guess, where were we? We were in Germany and I offered to drive them. So it was me and my wife at the time. And then in the back seat was John and Merce and the big picnic basket between them. And we're making the trek. Every once in a while, this hand would reach around from behind me with a peanut butter on a cracker. So he was feeding me and offering me fisherman's friends, and because he always had those with him too. And it was great. And on that very same drive, as I recall, I think on the way back, we stopped at Tini Duchamp's place for
in Villiers.
Yeah, for dinner. Yeah. And that was really quite incredible too.
Yeah, I got to spend time with Cage at Tini's place for like 3 nights. I think we were there together. He and Tini played chess endlessly. So the house.
They didn't do that while I was there.
They didn't. Well, no, Johnny had one
night. It was short.
But you had dinner? Was Mary Elaine there? Do you remember Mary Elaine?
No, there was a servant.
Yeah, Mary Elaine. She was like the housekeeper and also the cook. She was not very tall.
Well, maybe it was her then, yeah.
Did she speak English at all?
I don't think so.
I think she knew how, but she didn't speak it. Yeah. She would force you. She would speak to me in French, and my French at that time was so bad. And she would speak to me in French, and the more confused I got, the louder she would say it.
That always helps, of course.
Yeah. I don't know. Somehow she would always make me understand her sentences just by shouting at me.
I don't know why I thought it was a man.
Well, I wonder if it was Antoine. Was it Antoine Monnier?
It might have been.
Yeah, Antoine would have been her. What would that make Tini? That would have been, I honestly don't know, grandson, I guess? Antoine would be the grandson?
I don't know. It's a little unclear in my mind.
It was a long time ago, too.
It's a long time ago.
I forgive you. It's okay.
It's hard for me to believe how long ago some of this stuff.
I know.
And it's also hard for me to believe how long I've been doing this record label.
Yeah. It must be very hard to, I don't want to describe the water while you feel like you're drowning, but it must be very hard to have your life's work really kind of confronted by cultural change.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just must be really difficult. So it's not you choosing to do something else, but rather being sort of pushed into choice, pushed into or doing what you're doing differently or just because of the external movement of a culture. Must be hard.
Well, there was a point where I kind of had to make some kind of decision. The writing was on the wall, so to speak. You know, do I give up on Mode Records and do something else that would be more practical, you know, at least financially? It most certainly is not practical financially. And I thought about it. I mean, it was maybe about 10 years ago or so or less. And I decided not to change direction and stick with it, partly because I don't really know what else I would have done in its place. But also I figured, well, just tough it out and see how it goes.
No, and you're doing that. I mean, obviously, it's just hard. It's hard, though, you know, to not feel the ground under your feet, you know, when you're doing things. Yeah. I remember though, Merce, you just said something that reminded me of Merce Cunningham. It was a very funny moment. We were drinking a glass of wine and talking or something. And he told me about that wonderful quote by his father when he wanted to go to New York and his mother got really upset about it. And his father said, "You let that guy go. If that kid didn't have this dance thing, he'd be a crook," or something like that, which is a wonderful quote. Absolutely true. But what I'm remembering is that Merce said when we were sitting together, he said, "Well, you're so lucky. You have skills that you can apply to anything. You could apply what you know how to do to any number of professions." He said, "I just know how to make steps," you know, and I just thought that was a burden for him, you know, that he went through life with this feeling that, thank God, people like me because I don't know what else I would do, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought we would listen to Roratorio today. Is that okay with you?
It's one of my favorite Cage pieces.
Me too. Oh, I'm so glad. Will you tell the listening audience about Roratorio?
You mean the history of the piece?
No, what the piece is, just what it is.
Well, my release of it was taken from the WDR, which is where it was produced. But basically, it has, you know, several simultaneous layers. So there's the layer of the recordings where Cage went through Finnegan's Wake and You correct me if I get any of this wrong.
I can totally tell them. I can tell okay. them. We talked about it, as I said, in the program with Jeff Armel. Yeah. So I can do it really simply. Right. I just thought you might enjoy it, but you can give us little side bits if you want to.
So, he went through the book and notated all the locations.
All the sounds.
And all the sound. And then he wrote to people and asked them who lived in these near these locations to make a recording of something just ambient recording.
Right, right.
And then he collected all these things and he had a system of organizing them in such a way. And they became kind of a soundscape.
Yeah. A soundscape of Finnegan's Wake.
Right. And then on top of that, he had Irish musicians playing traditional Irish music. And then there was the component of his reading, his misostics through Finnegan's Wake, which is absolutely amazing.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Do you, I like to give guests a little present. Do you have a copy of the reading for the second time through Finnegan's Wake, the hardbound copy from Allison Knowles and Dick Higgins? They're signed and numbered by Cage. Talk about editions. They're signed. It's an edition.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. I'll get you one. That would be a perfect thing for you.
Great. But I went all out with this particular edition because of Roratorio, because I loved his spoken part so much that when we licensed the recordings, we not only licensed the completely mixed Roratorio, but I also included just his reading on the disc as well, because I know it's okay with Cage, but it always bothered me that sometimes you can't hear him because he gets drowned by all
the Beaudrons or the piccolos.
And then there was also an interview with him and Klaus Schoening, who was the redactor of Hörspiel at the WDR. So I included an excerpt of that. So you got all of that on the two CD set.
It's a beautiful, beautiful set. And the booklet itself is a collector's item. I mean, the booklet is just so beautiful.
Yeah.
I don't know how many pages it's got, but it's a thick little book.
Very, very big, yeah. And there's two books, actually. There's the book with the essays and so on, and then there's the other book that has all of the misostics.
That's right. And it's called, I want to say, What's Left Tears. Is that the conversation with Klaus?
That's the conversation.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a beautiful CD, you guys, if you can get your hands on it.
Thank you.
I don't know, is it out of print?
The physical CD is out of stock, but everything is available online.
What did they do about the booklet when they do that?
You get a PDF.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to me, that's not quite the same, but people seem to be okay with that.
Yeah.
I like to hold something. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm a product person myself. I'm not big on streaming. But I know it's going bye-bye. CDs are. There's going to come a time in the near, not so distant future when I'm not even going to be able to buy CDs.
Yeah. Well, they're making it very hard to buy them. I'll tell you that. I think it's kind of hit a low plateau, the sales. And I think it might just hang around at this low level for a while. But of course, a lot of companies, it's going to be too low of a level of sales and they just won't.
They just won't carry them.
Yeah. But I will continue making them as long as it makes any reasonable financial sense.
Till they pry them out of your cold, dead hands.
Exactly. And I should say with Roratorio, too, I love the piece so much that just a couple of years ago or so, I was in touch with John David Fulleman. And the idea of remixing it in surround, which I thought would be extraordinary with that piece.
No question. This is a piece, by the way, that's performed, at least when it's performed with Merce Cunningham's choreography, on a round stage.
And he was interested and he had ideas about how that could be easily realized from the original way of them putting it together. But unfortunately, that's yet another thing that didn't happen because sales of DVDs and Blu-rays plummeted so much that it doesn't really make sense to do it. I mean, I guess I should basically say that my credo with the label has never been to really make money, but you have to be, in these days, especially pragmatic enough that you just don't lose too much money.
Right, exactly.
So that could really be the end of you I just have to be pragmatic about it, and we never realized the project. But it would be great to actually realize it with Fulhamin while he can have his input.
While John David is around. Is he still in Sweden?
Yes.
Yeah. Brian, we're going to have to stop. If we're going to play any music today, we have to stop.
Okay.
I hope you'll come back. We can do another conversation. Maybe we can do a whole Roratorio show.
Oh, that would be my pleasure.
Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Take care of yourself. I hope to have a burger with you at Boitsen's soon.
Let's hope so. I'm ready to go out to eat. Okay. Just not indoors yet. I'm not ready.
I know. Okay. Take care of yourself. We'll be talking soon.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks. Now let's listen to an excerpt from Roratorio, a work from 1979 for voice, tape, and any number of musicians playing traditional Irish instruments, originally on tape. Roratorio is Cage's only realization of another of his scores, which is entitled Blank, comma, Blank, Blank, Circus on Blank, which is itself a means for translating a book into a performance without actors, one that is both literary and musical, or one or the other. The first blank of the title of this score is the title the realization will take. The second and third consist of an article and an adjective. And the last is the title of the book on which the work is based. Hence, Roratorio's full title is Roratorio, An Irish Circus on Finnegan's Wake. The premiere performance took place in Donaueschingen, its instrumentation noted as John Cage voice with Irish musicians and 62-track tape. It is dedicated to Klaus Schoening of the WDR Cologne, who commissioned it. This excerpt is from Mode Records CD 2829, number 6, a double CD in the Cage edition, which comes with a separate audio recording of Cage's lengthy misostic text, the second of five writings through Finnegan's Wake he made throughout his life, as well as two substantial booklets totaling 120 pages that are full of marvelous notes and transcriptions. The title, by the way, comes from Joyce, from page 41 of the edition Cage had at hand. Joyce writes, "With their priggish mouths all pen for the large appreciation of this long-awaited messiah of Roratorios, we're only half past at sweep, and after a brisk pause at a pawnbroking establishment for the prophetic purpose of redeeming the songster's truly admirable false teeth."
Is that the help? What you got? The father. Or did you walk? Thank you.
building to the green black. Confusion. This car on top. So keeping his big made hawks.
My sat is a fight. I could
tis
never
a
juke.
Swap hats and extract the standards. As it can see, I come from
rough. Then I sat down and I wrote a song. I wrote it deep, I wrote it
Dublin's
long.
Dublin's
John
made
my I shared
and Gerald and who and his there too.
The winter is fast and the leaves the time has passed since we have been. I hope to God the day will come.
Jubilees scattered on families symbolizing him. The Celtic folk, his house, the garden, the barrier, the gods.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.